content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And first today, teach students how to think, not what to think. And this was written by Sian Leah Baylock. Across the country, people are questioning the value and role of higher education, and institutions, particularly the elite ones, are experiencing a crisis in public trust. On top of that, tech titans are convinced that AI will break higher education. While many observers lament its corrupting influence and ask whether the mind-expanding purpose and qualities of a university, as one historian of education put it recently, are gone forever. The idea that higher education has outlived its usefulness to society, however, requires taking an astonishingly narrow view of the true purpose of the university. Higher education is not merely the transfer of knowledge. We live in an age of informational opulence. We are awash in readily available data, but lacking discernment, communication skills, and empathy. As a cognitive scientist, I have studied the negative consequences of excessive information. We are in a state of constant information overload, under assault by relentless alerts, updates, and notifications. Research shows that the cognitive burden of lots of information coming at us simultaneously can negatively affect our brains and ultimately our performance, especially when we are not experts in the topics we are bombarded with. Despite the reforms that our institutions of higher education must embark on to ensure that we are teaching our students how to think and not what to think, a four-year residential college experience remains one of the most powerful human environments for cultivating human qualities. As Dartmouth's president, I see this up close. Our small, tight-knit academic community promotes interdisciplinary collaboration in ways that are both intentional and serendipitous. For more than 20 years, our faculty in Jewish and Middle Eastern studies have co-taught classes and built deep trust with one another and their students. It was this trust that allowed them to hold difficult, sometimes painful, but ultimately enlightening conversations about the heinous terrorist attacks of October 7th and the brutal war in Gaza that has followed. This type of dialogue is virtually impossible to produce in online environments that are fragmented and hostile. On platforms engineered to reward outrage, where it is far too easy to dehumanize those with whom we disagree. Instead, we need to create and seek out venues that are distinctly human for developing, testing, and debating the ideas that shape our world. Faculty leading small classes characterized by face-to-face learning and an intergenerational exchange of views are needed now more than ever. The best among them show our students how to hold contradictory thoughts simultaneously, how to argue the merits of viewpoints different from our own, and how to make sense of a complicated world in a meaningful way, something AI has yet to master. Students, in turn, take these conversations into late-night debates in the dining hall or dorm room, uninterrupted by the likes, reposts, and anonymous comments they'd find online. The goal of a college or university is to impart and to allow the opportunity to practice the deeply human power skills, critical thinking, emotional intelligence, ethical discernment, collaborative leadership, that are required to successfully and happily move into adulthood. But those skills need practice, and right now, students are getting fewer and fewer opportunities to develop them. The pandemic disrupted face-to-face dialogue during a crucial stage of social development for the generation of students who are now enrolled in and applying to colleges. Social media has worsened the problem. and now generative AI risks removing real-time human engagement from the equation altogether. My colleague Christy Clemens, who runs a program called Dartmouth Dialogues, our initiative to promote human interaction across difference, tells a story that captures this shift. Years ago, students with interpersonal conflicts came to her office to talk things through in person, together. Then they stopped and just started texting each other. In the past few years, text exchanges have vanished, and conflict plays out on long voice memos that students leave for each other. No interaction, no back and forth. The one thing most likely to repair a relationship, direct human dialogue, is gone. Without the skill and will to listen across lines of difference, young people risk becoming more isolated, more easily manipulated, and less prepared to lead in a pluralistic democracy. If they don't learn how to engage in these practices here in college, they may not ever. The problem isn't just a lack of dialogue, it's rising polarization. As the Dartmouth political scientist Sean Westwood has shown, disparaging those with whom you disagree as the other erodes trust and discourages even the attempt at conversation or engaging across the aisle. That might sound abstract, but in the age of AI, this siloing has tangible consequences. When students retreat into algorithmically curated feeds or AI tools that reflect their own assumptions and validate even their worst impulses, the divide deepens. Machines are good at confirming biases, real and perceived, not challenging them. We need people to do this hard work themselves by leaving their information bubbles and interacting with one another in the flesh, not from behind a keyboard. You might be surprised to learn that I am a tech optimist. The field of artificial language intelligence began at Dartmouth, after all. And in the 1960s, our researchers made computing widely accessible with the invention of BASIC. Soon after, we gave all students computers and required them to develop computer literacy, not to train programmers, but to ensure that everyone could use new tools wisely. Today, we are doing the same with AI, piloting our first-year students' writing with AI in the classroom, and our faculty are using AI as a provocative collaborator, helping them translate ideas, explore new directions, and discover unexpected connections. As disruptive and transformative as artificial intelligence may be, the shape of our future will be determined not by machines, but by the wisdom with which we use them. We are embracing AI, but only because we are simultaneously embracing what we are exceptionally prepared to do in our college environment, focusing on what it means to be human. That's why, even before classes begin, every incoming Dartmouth student embarks on a hiking, canoeing, or camping trip led by an upper-class student. I will admit that having 1,200 students off in the woods with no faculty gives the college president nightly worries. But no phones, no adults, just peers learning to talk, think, and connect with people they've never met is worth it. It's a tradition rooted in the belief that community begins with conversation. I hear regularly from alumni who graduated decades ago, who form friendships for life, relationships that started on these trips and shaped who they are today. As AI accelerates and as polarization flares around us, higher education must hold fast to its human mission. Our job is to help the next generation cultivate their uniquely human skills, which, first and foremost, means being able to communicate with one another. Next, sex ed should cover fertility, too. This story by Olga Kazan. When Anna D'Souza was in her early 30s, she asked her OBGYN when she should start thinking about having kids. "When you were 26," she remembers the doctor saying. She was surprised. She'd had some sense that fertility decreases with age, but didn't know how significantly the drop-off was. No doctor had ever told her, and she certainly didn't learn about it in school. She took sex ed at her New Jersey high school in the late 1990s, but she said it focused mostly on trying to scare students out of having sex. She remembers little about the class besides watching a graphic VHS video of a woman giving birth. D'Souza, a journalist in Philadelphia, now wishes that class had included the basics of fertility and reproduction. A more robust sex ed program, she thinks, could have prompted her to check her egg count or freeze her eggs when she was younger, or even try to have kids sooner. She ended up having twins at 36, after two rounds of IVF, and later a son, also through IVF. But if she had known more about her fertility earlier in her life, she might have tried for a family the good, old-fashioned, fun way, she says, instead of the needles way. Teenagers, she believes, should understand that just because they don't want kids at 16 doesn't mean they don't want kids forever. She's far from the only person who feels this way. Fertility doctors and other experts told me that better sex education, with a curriculum that explains both how to prevent pregnancy and how to boost fertility, could help more families have the number of children they desire. This is especially essential as more people wait until they're older to start trying to have kids. According to the doctors I spoke with, many patients arrive at fertility clinics filled with misconceptions about their own reproductive biology. It's been stunning how ill-informed so many people are, Michael Zinneman, a reproductive endocrinologist in New York, told me. The doctors I spoke with pointed to some things that they believe all women and men should know about fertility, but in many cases don't. Most obvious, getting pregnant is easier when you're young. When women see stories in the media about female celebrities who have a baby at 50, Rashmi Kudasia, a reproductive endocrinologist in Houston, told me, they might assume it's likely to happen for them, too. Additionally, Kudasia said some of her patients don't realize that their being underweight or overweight could contribute to infertility, as can untreated sexually transmitted infections. Or they don't know that doctors advise women to take a prenatal vitamin containing folic acid, essential to the development of a fetus, even when they're only thinking about getting pregnant. Men should know, too, that lifestyle factors, including alcohol and tobacco use, can affect their sperm quality, which in turn can affect their partner's likelihood of getting pregnant. Those who may end up trying to conceive later in life could benefit from even more information, Zinneman told me, that many of his patients don't know that a woman has a brief window each month during which it's possible to get pregnant. Kudasia said that some of her patients come in with overly optimistic views of how well treatments such as IVF can work. Surveys of women's knowledge of fertility lend support to these anecdotes. A 2023 study of nearly 1,800 women ages 18 to 29 found that only 59% knew the phase during a menstrual cycle when they were most likely to get pregnant, and most erroneously thought a woman's ovaries continually make eggs until she reaches menopause. Women are born with all of the eggs they'll ever have, and the eggs' quality and quantity diminish with time. In a 2016 study of mostly low-income women, just over half knew what ovulation meant, and fewer than a third knew when it occurs. In a 2017 study, reproductive age women correctly answered an average of only about 16 out of 29 fertility questions, covering topics such as the percentage of pregnancies that end in miscarriage and the lifestyle factors that decrease fertility. Women studying to become doctors fared little better, answering an average of only about 19 questions correctly, leading the authors to conclude that fertility knowledge is low among U.S. women of reproductive age, including those with children, and even among medical trainees. Even women who are actively trying to get pregnant tend to be underinformed. A 2021 review found that women who wanted to conceive had low to moderate fertility knowledge. A 2022 study of women struggling to conceive, only a quarter correctly recognized the week during their cycle when they had the highest chance of getting pregnant. This lack of knowledge has real consequences. A lot of the misunderstanding around fertility and reproductive health lends people to either not be able to have the family size that they desire, Kudasia said, or to have lost a lot of time along the way. That's in part why Kudasia and some other doctors think that fertility should be taught as a standard part of sex ed in schools. Although doctors could try to give patients this information themselves, most doctors' appointments are too brief for a long lecture on ovulation, and some patients don't bring up fertility challenges until after they've started trying to have a baby. What I hear all the time is people thinking that, well, if my age is a concern with regards to fertility, my doctor will bring it up to me, she said. And that's definitely not a fair assumption. What's more, doctors who specialize in fertility often have long wait times for appointments, and some don't accept insurance, putting their counsel out of the reach for many. Better sex ed in middle school and high school, including lessons on ovulation and fertility cycles, could help make people aware earlier in their life of the factors they need to consider if they eventually want to have children. Fertility education in school also has the potential to reach far more people than individual doctors can. Not everyone goes to the doctor every year, but almost everyone goes to middle school and high school. Fertility education efforts haven't been studied extensively, but the limited research that does exist suggests they can be effective. Studies from Canada, Spain, and Japan found that exposure to information about fertility at least temporarily increased young adults' knowledge of the topic. Conversely, the consequences of educators not broaching the topic in schools can be significant. In a 2019 study based on interviews with 54 American women experiencing infertility, several noted that the conspicuous absence of conversations about reproductive health and fertility from their schools, such sex education. One 39-year-old woman told the study's authors that if she and her husband had known more about fertility earlier, we would not have waited so long before trying to conceive. Some places have already implemented a more robust sex ed in their schools. California recently enacted a Know Your Period law, modeled after a similar law in Washington, D.C., which requires schools to teach all middle and high school students about the menstrual cycle and menopause. And about 500 school districts across the country use a comprehensive curriculum called Rights, Respect, Responsibility, which covers menstruation, the fertile window, and how an embryo implants in a uterus. Kudasia praised one lesson from the curriculum as excellent, saying it seemed like an age-appropriate way of discussing things. She told me, when you're in high school or younger, we often get the impression that if you just touch a boy, you're going to get pregnant. A more well-rounded sex ed curriculum would show that it's not quite that simple. But these programs face the same headwinds that sex ed in general contends with. Attempts to expand sex ed in schools typically fail for a few reasons, among them that some school districts can't afford to train teachers and develop or purchase additional curricula about sexuality, and anything having to do with sex and bodies can be highly contentious among parents. Kudasia noted that the Rights, Respect, and Responsibility curriculum might not be popular in today's political climate because it includes discussions of gender identity, a fact that the curriculum has been scrutinized for in the past. The Trump administration, too, has been keen on the idea of fertility education. though not primarily through school-based sex ed. In April, the New York Times reported that a policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation proposed to the White House that it use government funds to educate women about their menstrual cycles. And in July, the Times wrote that the administration was offering a $1.5 million grant to start an infertility training center aimed at helping women conceive. But Robin Jensen, a University of Utah communications professor who has researched sex ed, points out that these programs seem as if they're aiming to increase the U.S. birth rate and not to also help people prevent pregnancy, if they desire. Fertility education is needed in sex education, Jensen told me, but it needs to be the kind that is designed to increase fertility awareness and knowledge across the board, rather than the kind that offers only part of the story. Young people themselves seem to want to have this more expansive, impartial information about reproduction. The idea for California's period bill came from a high school student, Sriya Srivinvasan, who had stopped menstruating for 3 years, didn't understand why, and felt too embarrassed to ask her doctor. She told me that she thinks kids should have a place to learn about reproduction other than the internet, a place where, as she put it about a hypothetical student, I can sit and listen to this, but I don't have to feel that stigma or shame from searching it up online myself, or I don't have to feel the stigma of my family shaming me. Ideally, Srinivasan and other teenagers would come away from sex ed understanding both how not to get pregnant and how to get pregnant. Basic information about the human body that the body's owner deserves to know. Our third story. The U.S. is quietly pausing some arms sales to Europe. Written by Vivian Salama. The first clue that something had changed in the U.S. approach to selling military equipment to Europe came as Denmark neared a decision on the purchase of a multi-billion-dollar air defense system. For weeks, American and French negotiators had aggressively pursued the deal. But as the deadline approached, the Pentagon suddenly lost interest. We couldn't understand why, a contractor who had been tracking the discussions told me. It seemed like a no-brainer, but they just weren't into it. Then on a call earlier this month with the State Department, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Elbridge Colby, said that he didn't believe that the value in certain military sales, according to two administration officials with knowledge of the discussion. He added that he didn't like the idea of selling Patriots to Denmark, because they are in short supply and should be reserved for the United States to use as needed. The comments surprised some state officials, but they soon learned it wasn't just Denmark having its access cut off. Current and former administration officials told me the Pentagon has identified some weapons as being in short supply and is moving to block new requests for those systems coming in from Europe. It wasn't immediately clear to those I spoke with how long the hold will last, how many weapons are on the list, or even if it could expand to include even more weapons. Few exemptions will be granted. There have been concerns about Patriot shortages for months. The U.S. has only about 25% of the missile interceptors needed for the Pentagon's military plans, according to Defense Department officials. But the Patriot doesn't really have a European equivalent, which makes it a valuable and highly sought-after system across the continent, newly concerned about aerial attacks, a risk driven home today after Estonia, a NATO member, said that Russian military jets had violated its airspace. If the hold is long-term, it risks creating new rifts with allies, weakening their defenses at a time when Russia poses an imminent threat, and diminishing U.S. military influence across the continent. The change would also mean a loss of billions of dollars of government and private revenue, reducing the number of jobs in the defense industry, limiting product expansion, and curtailing research and development. Military sales have long been a key tool of U.S. foreign policy, a way to secure national security interests abroad by bolstering friends' defense capabilities. The United States first began to sell military equipment to nations it deemed friendly as a way to shore up alliances at the height of the Cold War and expand its influence overseas. American anti-ship missiles, rocket launchers, and fighter jets are bolstering Taiwan's ability to defend itself against the threat of a Chinese invasion. Priorities have changed as more America First devotees populate the senior ranks of President Donald Trump's second administration. The administration appears poised to prioritize replenishing American stockpiles over its relationships with longtime allies. The State Department's counselor, Michael Needham, pushed back on suggestions that the department had been blindsided. Anybody trying to create stories of a rift between state and the Department of War is doing so because they are opposed to President Trump's America First agenda. Officials and observers of the Trump administration say the change is on brand with Colby's belief that China is the only country that has the ambition, resources, and military might to knock off the U.S. off its pedestal as the world's leading superpower. Several European nations have sent some of their best weapons to Ukraine to help it defend itself against Russia's invasion. And in turn, they were buying U.S.-made weapons to backfill their stockpiles. We tell Europeans we want them to send weapons to Ukraine and buy replacements, but then we say, you can't have them. Mark Kantsian, a retired military colonel and senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, told me, we also tell them to defend themselves, but then we tell them we won't sell them the things that they need to do that. The war in Ukraine has strained stockpiles not only in the U.S. but across Europe, leading to discussions about how better to revitalize the defense industrial base. If the discussions to hold weapons result in a slowdown, allies will inevitably start taking their business elsewhere. If you are a country in Europe that is very mindful of Russian missiles or drones flying into your airspace, you are anxious to make sure you've got interceptors in stock. If you're told the already 2-year wait is now going to be a 5-year wait, you'll be very incentivized to start looking for other alternatives. That last article was edited a bit due to time, because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.